They're shocked. People say they're scared. Some people say they're indignant. You get a lot of different comments from people. There are reports of lines forming at stores where people are stocking up. People are trying to get medicine. There is a little bit of panic there. We sent out a reporter to go talk to people and interview them on the streets. NPR has been asking for a visa to get into Venezuela for months, and we cannot get in. The reporter that we sent out, she's in the eastern reaches of the city, and she was outside a big market, and she said people are just stocking up on whatever they can, but people don't have a lot of money, so they can't really stock up. The economy is shattered in Venezuela. Most people just talked about being scared and woken up to these explosions. One retiree said she was very glad that Maduro was gone. She said that something had to change because the economy's so bad and you can barely feed your family. But there were others who actually were indignant and called this a violation of sovereignty. And even a few called the pre-dawn attack cowardly, but they said they weren't going out to the streets. They were going to get their goods and then go home. There is no love loss for Maduro in widespread love loss for him in Venezuela. He's been in power for more than 10 years. And since the widely disputed election last year, that gave him another victory. And he's cracked down hard on the opposition and just jailing people for speaking out against the regime.
We're going to be hearing from President Trump in just a few moments, but let me turn now to NPR's justice correspondent, Ryan Lucas. You've been following this massive months-long military buildup in the Caribbean. Lucas, remind us about the charges against Maduro.
Well, I think it's important to remember, first off, that Maduro was actually, the Justice Department first announced charges against him in 2020. So almost 6 years ago, it was March of 2020, alleging that there was this vast narco-trafficking conspiracy that he was basically at the head of. And then today, after his capture was announced, the Justice Department actually released a superseding indictment in the Southern District of New York, so in Manhattan, against Maduro and other officials, including his wife. There are four charges against Nicolas Maduro: narco-terrorism conspiracy, cocaine importation conspiracy, possession of machine guns, and conspiracy to possess machine guns. And essentially what this indictment does, it's more than 20 pages, but kind of boiled down to the essence, is it alleges that Maduro and the other officials who are charged in here were at the head of a relentless campaign of cocaine trafficking, that Maduro and his co-defendants provided law enforcement cover and logistical support for cocaine shipments to the United States, and they worked in partnership with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, so FARC, other armed groups in Colombia, as well as in Mexico, quite notably the Sinaloa cartel, which was headed by El Chapo, most famously, as well as the Tren de Aragua gang in Venezuela. And so what they allege in this 20-plus page indictment is, as I said, this vast cocaine conspiracy where they provided essentially cover for these narco-terrorist groups to send cocaine to the United States, knowing that it would have a negative effect on the American public.
Ryan, Senator Tim Kaine told me earlier that Congress did not get any announcement, any warning of this strike. And I'm curious, what is the administration's legal rationale?
Well, from sources who I've spoken with, it's my understanding that the administration briefed Congress after the operation had begun, that the administration told congressional leadership that the president was acting under his Article II authority as commander in chief, and that essentially what the administration said was that the military was taking action to assist the Justice Department in executing an arrest warrant against Maduro and his wife. But certainly there have been questions from members of Congress about the broader actions that we have seen against Venezuela, against drug boats in the Caribbean, as well as the Eastern Pacific, blowing those drug boats up. And there are going to continue to be, I think, questions about the legal rationale and the legal justification that the administration is putting forward. Again, we have not heard from the administration directly on publicly on its rationale for the action that we saw today.
Okay. Franco Ordonez, since this strike, what have we been hearing from President Trump?
Yeah, I mean, he had an interview earlier this morning, a very brief one with the New York Times, where he called it a brilliant operation. And then he spoke a little bit more extensively on Fox and Friends, actually just a little bit ago, where we learned some more new things. He said that there were no fatalities on the U.S. side, but there were some injuries. He said he actually watched the operation in real time from a room in Mar-a-Lago, surrounded by generals. And he talked in the interview about watching the troops go through doors and knock down doors that were not supposed to do doors and just execute the operation, in his words, just like no one else could. Trump said also that there were a massive number of aircraft ready, including helicopters and fighter jets. He also said that, you know, that the U.S. was prepared for a second wave, but didn't think that would be necessary. One thing I did find very interesting was that Trump did say that the U.S. would be very involved in the future direction of Venezuela's future, saying that the U.S. is making decisions now and they just can't let anyone run it. He was asked about Maria Machado, the opposition leader who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, and whether he would support her. He didn't go that far. He said that there's a vice president and they're going to see how things are going. But clearly, he said they will be very much involved, and that'll be very interesting to watch.
Greg Myrie, national security correspondent, let me turn to you. What is the day after plan for Venezuela? What do we even know about who is running the country now?
Yeah, absolutely. Very key question, Daniel. Again, it seems that the vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, seems to be in charge, saying she's activating these plans that Maduro had put in place. So will the U.S. allow her to stay in power and see how that plays out? But there are just so many questions we don't have answers to. You know, dozens, hundreds of people are around Maduro and formed part of his regime. Are they going to stay and try to continue their positions? Would they be willing to step down? Will they try to flee? What will the military do there? You know, these calls for the military to defend the country, but it doesn't appear at this point that the U.S. operation is ongoing, that there are no U.S. forces there as far as we can tell right now. So is this just going to sort of play itself out internally? What role will the U.S. try to do to help shape a new government there? And we just don't know. And these day after plans are so critical, as we've seen in other U.S. operations over the years. So big, big unknown.
Yeah. Ada Peralta, NPR's correspondent in Mexico. President Trump tried to move President Maduro one time before in 2019. You were there, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was in 2019. The U.S. had been increasing sanctions against Venezuela. They had recognized Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. And there was an expectation that huge popular protests across the country would convince President Maduro's military to turn against him. I saw thousands of people surround the military base in the middle of Caracas, and nothing happened that year. Nothing changed. The military didn't turn on Maduro. And today, that same military base was bombed. I think this marks a significant shift for the United States. For decades now, it had bet that it could get its way in the Western Hemisphere with soft power by supporting economic sanctions, supporting popular movements. And this is a return. It marks a return to the early 1900s, a time when the U.S. was not so shy about using its military power to remove or impose leaders in the region.
Ryan, let me go to you, Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, because I'm curious, have we seen a U.S. capture of a sitting foreign leader followed by a legal trial? Is there any precedent here?
Well, that's a bit of a curveball, Daniel. you know, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I mean, there's the argument that Operation Just Cause that led to the capture and removal of Manuel Noriega, who was a strong man in Panama, might, as Franco said at the top, is probably the closest parallel that we have. But I think that there are a couple of things that are particularly interesting to me that I'm going to be keeping an eye on in terms of what the president says and what we hear. One is the U.S. government had offered a $50 million bounty for information leading to the arrest or capture of Maduro. It will be interesting to hear how exactly they got to him and what role that may have played. The other thing that I'm going to be keeping an ear out for is this question of how they talk about this. Is this part of an effort to change Venezuela, or is this part of an effort to kind of crack down on drug trafficking and the war against drugs? And I say that in part because looking at the indictment, one of the things that this alleges is this vast conspiracy to ship tons of cocaine to the United States through the Caribbean and through Central America. And that includes Honduras. And recently, the president pardoned the former president of Honduras,
That's right.
who had been convicted and sentenced for leading a massive drug trafficking conspiracy. And that timeline overlaps with the alleged conspiracy that we see here in the indictment against Maduro. So there is a bit of friction here between what the administration talks about as its war on drug trafficking and some of the actions that we've seen from the administration itself. So I'm interested to keep an eye on that and see how they talk about that and see how ultimately this is all justified.
Greg Myrie, we're going to be hearing from President Trump momentarily. Presumably about some of the details of the planning of this operation. What do we know so far about the planning and the execution of what really was a surprise operation?
Yeah, Daniel, we don't know a lot. We heard Trump make these threats for months. This U.S. buildup in the region began back in August. Trump kept threatening Maduro. We've seen the strikes on the suspected drug trafficking boats, the seizure of oil tankers. But this actual operation was very much kept under wraps. Now, Trump spilled a little bit, saying that this was the countdown was going on. This could have happened a few days ago, perhaps on New Year's Eve, but issues like the weather and all postponed it or delayed it for just a bit. So obviously, this was a well-planned operation, but it could have happened a couple days earlier. But it was kept under wraps. We weren't hearing anything that anything like this was imminent. It also appears it was carried out by a special operations force. We may hear more details on that. I would certainly expect those to come out either in Trump's comments or in other forms shortly thereafter. We don't know the full scale and scope. We know it appeared to involve several places, not just Caracas, the capital, but according to the Venezuela government, the U.S. hit several spots along the northern coast near the Caribbean or just slightly inland. And there were obviously preparations, as Trump noted, to send in additional forces if needed. But certainly a lot of details that we haven't heard. You would certainly have to say it seemed from a U.S. perspective to go well, that it began around 2 o'clock in the morning. And within a few hours, Trump was tweeting taking to Truth Social and saying that Maduro and his wife had been captured and flown out of the country.
So it may have gone well from a military perspective, but let's focus again on Congress. We heard earlier from Senator Tim Kaine, Congress did not provide authorization, was not given any indication of this strike. Franco Ordonez, how do you see that? And do you hear from members of his administration, does Trump seem to have the full support of the White House for this?
I mean, I think speaking of the Congress question first, I mean, I think this is just another example of how this president is expanding and using his executive power while diminishing the role of Congress. Throughout this pressure campaign, the president has been, kind of pushing Congress to the side. And Congress, in large part, has been somewhat deferring to the president. You know, they've tried to put up a little bit of pushback from Democrats, but have not gotten very far. I will note that after the recent strike, the double tap strike, that was the second strike on an earlier strike that killed survivors, Congress has been taking a little bit more action. You're seeing a little bit more oversight. There were hearings after that one. I think after this, with this latest escalation, I think you're going to have a lot more questions. You know, speaking to what Ader was saying about U.S. intervention in South America, in Latin America, there's going to be a lot lot of concerns about that, considering the challenges that the United States have faced over the years. You know, Obama, former Presidents Bush and Obama, you know, spent much time trying to repair relations with Latin America. So to go back to that time would be very, very interesting. I will say, you know, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the National Security Advisor, did, you know, brief with Senator Mike Lee, and Senator Lee did give some information about the strikes, you know, talking about criminal charges, and he certainly seemed to be approving of this. So they are certainly going to have their allies in Congress, but I think there is no question that the scrutiny is going to be high.
And I think what also is significant about this is Trump's willingness to use military force so often in his second term compared to his first term. He's not even a full year into this term. He's bombed four countries in the Middle East, two countries in Africa, in addition to what we've seen with the boat strikes and off the coast of Venezuela. And a real red line for Trump seemed to be sending in troops on the ground. Now, in this case, it looks like in Venezuela, and they were in there for perhaps a matter of hours and grabbed Maduro and his wife and have left the country. But nonetheless, we've seen Trump time and again, really the seventh separate country that has suffered from U.S. military force in the past year.
If I can just jump in here, I would say that I think historically, if a U.S. military mission is successful at the outset, there can be celebration among political figures, particularly in administration that conducted it. But I think what you end up seeing is a lot of criticism over time if, after the removal of a head of state, the situation goes south. That's the situation that we saw in Iraq after the removal of Saddam Hussein. So it's important to bear that in mind, that this is not over now just because Maduro and his wife have been captured and removed from the country. There's going to be a long tail to this, and ultimately Trump is on the hook for that because he's the one who authorized the action to remove them.
Ryan Lucas, let me stay with you. Just remind us about how this campaign really has been building up over the course of several months since, I think, late August.
Well, yeah, we saw the first military action against alleged drug boats in the Caribbean in early September. And since then, they've hit more than 30, I think, boats in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific that the administration says are carrying drugs. This is part of what the administration presented this buildup initially as an effort to cut down or essentially to stop drug trafficking into the United States. A lot of sources who I've spoken with who worked on that very issue for the career said that when it comes to stopping drug trafficking into the United States, it's kind of a fool's errand. It's not possible to do because these cartels have deep pockets. They have resources that can allow them to either wait out the military action that the U.S. was doing or to adjust. But certainly there were questions as to whether the United States was really the Trump administration was focused on curbing drug trafficking or whether this was about Maduro ultimately. And I think we've perhaps gotten an answer to that question today.
Yeah. We're going to be hearing from President Trump momentarily, speaking about the extraordinary events of the past several hours, starting overnight, the U.S. Arresting and taking President Nicolas Maduro to the United States. Greg Myrie, give us the big picture here. What is this all about? It's regime change. What is the U.S. looking for? Oil dominance in the region?
Well, we saw recently as the U.S. Released its national security strategy, talking about its global intentions for this administration. Clearly, there was an emphasis placed on the Western Hemisphere. And we've seen from this administration talk about the U.S. should be dominant in this hemisphere, and also suggesting that almost by default, or even and sometimes hinted at, that Russia and its region in Europe and China will be dominant. This will be the competition of big powers with those countries I've mentioned dominating their region. So you could certainly look at it in that sense. And in fact, it was talked about as an extension of the Monroe Doctrine from 200 years ago when President James Monroe talked about that there should be no interference from other from European powers. At that time, he was talking about shouldn't be interfering in this region. So there's clearly going to be a greater emphasis on Latin America, and this is the biggest move so far. But we've seen other moves related to that. The talk about the U.S. taking control of the Panama Canal, the tariff issue with a number of countries, you know, very, very friendly allied countries like Mexico and Argentina. So I think it should be seen in the context of a push by this administration to have greater U.S. influence over Latin America. And perhaps also related to this is the countries that Venezuela has supported or worked with, like Cuba, where it has provided a lot of cheap oil. What are going to be the knock-on effects in, say, Cuba, which may not get the oil that it's been receiving? Colombia is concerned about refugees flowing across the border into its country if Venezuela becomes more unstable. So lots of potential offshoots and second and third order effects could play out over time here.
Yeah. Kerry Khan in South America, you met recently the leading opposition figure from Venezuela, Maria Corina Machado. What are we hearing from her?
She was quite silent until just recently. She just put out a statement. It's unclear where she is exactly right now. She is not in Venezuela. She left the country after more than a year in hiding there to go accept her Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo. And she just put out a statement saying that peace and sovereignty are coming to Venezuela. She said that soon there will be order in the country. All the political prisoners will be released. And she says we will construct an exceptional country and bring our children home. She added that there is a plan coming forth for the day after in Venezuela, and she will announce that soon. And you were asking the question about regime change, and is this enough for the Trump administration? I just wanted to add that President Trump, when he was speaking on Fox and Friends, he was asked the question, what will happen to those officials left behind? And he did mention the Vice President, Delcy Rodriguez, that constitutionally in Venezuela should take over power. And he was asked, he said the loyalists, the Maduro loyalists, better convert. He didn't go on much, but he did say that they better convert or see what happens. But he did mention that they have this vice president now. And he was asked about Maria Corina Machado, and he didn't say much. So it'll be very curious to hear what he says coming up in the speech he's going to give right now.
You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. Let's go to Eder Peralta in Mexico. Eder, what are you hearing more broadly throughout Latin America?
I mean, this is an earthquake for the region, and it has a lot of governments on edge. You know, as we were talking earlier, the last time something like this happened was in 1989 when the U.S. invaded Panama to oust the country's military leader, Manuel Noriega. And Venezuela is way bigger, more powerful a country in the region. So mostly what we've been hearing in the region is condemnation. Colombia, Chile, Mexico, which is the U.S.'s biggest trading partner, have all condemned the operation. Brazil's president, Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, said this operation crossed an unacceptable line and that this was, and I'm quoting him here, another extremely dangerous precedent for the entire international community. I think the big picture here is that this operation tells us that anything is possible in the region. Cuba and Nicaragua, both loyal allies of Venezuela, are probably very worried right now. But so is Mexico. They're worried because Trump earlier today said on Fox News that this country is run by drug traffickers. And he said, quote, something is going to have to be done in Mexico.
Wow. Franco Ordonez is here in the studio. Let's speak about Secretary of State Marco Rubio. He has been quite hawkish on Venezuela and on Latin America more broadly. Put this in the context of an administration with a lot of support in South Florida, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to even, you know, to the first administration and even before. I mean, when Marco Rubio was the senator, this, you know, obviously for Florida and, you know, representing from Miami, you know, this is something that he has been pushing for years and years and years. The position on Venezuela, also Cuba, also Nicaragua, he has a very hardline position that even this summer he tweeted out that Maduro on X, that Maduro is, quote, not the president of Venezuela and his regime is not the legitimate government. He claimed that Maduro was the head of the Cartel de los Soles, you know, a narco-terrorist organization, according to the administration, and taken possession of the country. And as you say, you know, he is just one of a few people in very powerful positions who are kind of driving this policy. Now, take, for example, as well, Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, also, you know, also from the, you know, kind of from the Florida, you know, Florida area and kind of part of this Florida contingent in the administration. And then you can even go back even farther to the first Trump administration, where this was a big, you know, a big goal of the United States and a big goal of President Trump was to depose Maduro then. As Ader said earlier, you know, supporting Juan Guaido, who was the opposition leader at the time. This is something that in some people, in some of the experts I speak to, they call this a bit of unfinished business. But it is certainly, you know, the South Florida ties that Trump has certainly are playing an influence here politically.
And President Trump has posted moments ago on Truth Social a photo of the Venezuelan president. And you see him in a gray tracksuit with handcuffs on and messy hair. This happened in the middle of the night. We should go to you again, Greg Myrie, because I'm curious what you're thinking about this massive U.S. military buildup off the coast of Venezuela. Could we expect even further military action after the remarkable events of capturing the president?
Well, the presence is there, and Trump has said they could take more action if needed. I think it will run into some very tough questions if Venezuela stays relatively calm, but perhaps politically does not do what the Trump administration would like to see. Would the U.S. consider sending in additional force? Generally speaking, the size of this force, which is a dozen or more ships, 15,000 troops throughout the region, both at sea and on land, you don't want to keep them there indefinitely on a heightened state of alert. And just issues like refueling and keeping these systems going, these troops ready to go, you can't sort of do that indefinitely. So they'll sort of have to make a decision about whether they're going to use additional troops to do something with them in Venezuela, or perhaps pull back. And again, a lot of this, because of the size of the ships involved and the U.S. force involved, we'll be able to have some sense of what they're thinking. At the moment, it looks like, okay, this was a one-off operation, and hopefully this could be sorted out diplomatically or politically and not without additional force. Certainly no guarantee of that. You just don't know how various forces, the army, armed groups, or others may respond. So, yeah, the force is there, but we don't know what move they might make next.
And Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has tweeted some criticism of the U.S. attacks. She writes, "Americans disgust with our own government's never-ending military aggression and support of foreign wars is justified because we're forced to pay for it, and both parties, Republicans and Democrats, always keep the Washington military machine funded and going." And she writes, "This is what many in MAGA thought they voted to end. Boy, we were wrong." Franco Ordonez, your view of what the supporters of President Trump and in MAGA world, how are they going to view this moment?
Yeah, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is certainly one of those supporters who's, you know, come a little bit in conflict with the president, but certainly a representative of a lot of views in the MAGA world who are concerned that Trump has strayed from kind of his America First priorities. You know, this comment is just the latest in concerns about Trump's, you know, increased focus on foreign affairs and not enough, in their opinion, on domestic affairs. You know, Trump, you know, in addition to kind of concerns about where this is going to leave Venezuela and the future of Venezuela, there really is a question among his supporters about how they're going to feel about these aggressive actions. I mean, Trump came to power, you know, with an agenda focused on America First and putting Americans ahead of for other, you know, of other countries, the interests of other countries. So for this international focus in this term, it has really alienated some of these supporters like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others. I mean, I think, you know, if Trump comes out today and starts talking about a long-term investment, that is going to raise a lot of eyebrows. I think you're going to hear from others as well, such as Steve Bannon, who has raised concerns about Trump's recent comments on Iran. This is a significant issue that could play very much into this year's midterms.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. We are speaking about the extraordinary events of this past few hours. The U.S. has captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. President Trump has tweeted a photo of Maduro in a gray tracksuit and in handcuffs. Carrie Khan in South America, remind us just about what has transpired in these first hours of this extraordinary moment.
People were just woken up at 2 a.m. local time, just by these explosions throughout Caracas, and also according to the government in 3 other states, and they were just terrified. I spoke to a couple people. We've had some reporters out talking to people on the streets. Again, Venezuela has not given us visas, so we can't get into the country. But they've been talking to people that are in lines, long lines that are forming for medicine, for food. They were just kind of startled and shocked that the United States would move so aggressively against Venezuela. You hear some indignation, but you hear some relief, too. There is no widespread love lost for Maduro, who has been in power for more than 10 years there. I just have to say, Daniel, I saw that picture that the president has put out on his Truth Social, and that is going to raise a lot of alarms throughout Latin America once you see a handcuffed Maduro, you said, with his hair messed up. He seems to have some blinders on and ear. He's on the Iwo Jima, it says, the USS Iwo Jima that's been out in the Caribbean for months now. And so I just think we're going to hear a lot more indignation. It's funny, looking at live TV right now in Venezuela, and they're just showing shots of a big demonstration in Cuba. They're not on the streets in Caracas right now. We were seeing some small protests breaking out and people coming and condemning the United States and showing indignation. But right now we're just seeing shots of a plaza in Cuba and people talking about all rallying together against the imperialists and the capture of Maduro by the United States.
We're going to be hearing from President Trump momentarily about the U.S. capture of the Venezuelan president. Let's talk more about Latin America. Ada Peralta in Mexico, how do you see this moment and really the remaking of Latin America here?
I mean, this is a shocking moment. I think we can't understate how big a moment this is. It's something, you know, that takes us back to the 1900s, early 1900s, gunboat diplomacy, and it goes beyond that. I think we were looking at Honduras, which just had an election, and the U.S. President Trump forcefully endorsed the candidate. There were claims of fraud in that election, and the U.S.-backed candidate came up victorious. There was a lot of talk about how brazen the U.S. involvement had been in that election in Honduras that just happened a couple of months ago. And this just goes way beyond that, right? This is a military incursion into the capital of an adversary. And so this is the United States truly reasserting itself in the region with an absolutely brazen operation. This is the United States really going back to the Monroe Doctrine days, where it said the U.S. Or Latin America is our backyard, and we will assert ourselves in military ways. So I think what we're seeing right now from a lot of countries is shock that this has actually ended up in this way.
Okay, and we're going to the president now.
Big stuff. We appreciate you being here. Late last night and early today, at my direction, the United States Armed Forces conducted an extraordinary military operation in the capital of
Venezuela. Overwhelming American military power, air, land, and sea was used to launch a spectacular assault. And it was an assault like people have not seen since World War II. It was a force against a heavily fortified military fortress in the heart of Caracas to bring outlaw dictator Nicolas Maduro to justice. This was one of the most stunning, effective, and powerful displays of American military might and competence in American history. And if you think about it, then some other good ones like the attack on Soleimani, the attack on al-Baghdadi, and the obliteration and decimation of the Iran nuclear sites just recently in an operation known as Midnight Hammer, all perfectly executed and done. No nation in the world could achieve what America achieved yesterday, or frankly, in just a short period of time. All Venezuelan military capacities were rendered powerless as the men and women of our military working with U.S. law enforcement successfully captured Maduro in the dead of night. It was dark. The lights of Caracas were largely turned off due to a certain expertise that we have. It was dark and it was deadly. But captured along with his wife, Celia Flores, both of whom now face American justice. Maduro and Flores have been indicted in the Southern District of New York, Jay Clayton, for their campaign of deadly narco-terrorism against the United States and its citizens. I want to thank the men and women of our military who achieved such an extraordinary success overnight with breathtaking speed, power, precision, and competence. You rarely see anything like it. You've seen some raids in this country that didn't go so well. They were an embarrassment. If you look back to Afghanistan, or if you look back to the Jimmy Carter days, they were different days. We're a respected country again, like never before. These highly trained warriors operating in collaboration with U.S. law enforcement caught them in a very ready position. They were waiting for us. They knew we had many ships out in the sea, just sort of waiting. They knew we were coming. So they were in what's called a ready position. But they were completely overwhelmed and very quickly incapacitated. If you would have seen what I saw last night, you would have been very impressed. I'm not sure that you'll ever get to see it, but it was an incredible thing to see. Not a single American service member was killed, and not a single piece of American equipment was lost. We had many helicopters, many planes, many people involved in that fight. But think of that, not one piece of military equipment was lost, not one service member was, more importantly, killed. The United States military is the strongest and most fearsome military on the planet by far. With capabilities and skills our enemies can scarcely begin to imagine, we have the best equipment anywhere in the world. There's no equipment like what we have, and you see that. Even if you just look at the boats, you know, we've knocked out 97% of the drugs coming in by sea. 90%. Each boat kills 25,000 people. We knocked out 97%. And those drugs mostly come from a place called Venezuela. We're going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition. So we don't want to be involved with having somebody else get in, and we have the same situation that we had for the last long period of years. So we are going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition, and it has to be judicious, because that's what we're all about. We want peace, liberty, and justice for the great people of Venezuela, and that includes many from Venezuela that are now living in the United States and want to go back to their country. It's their homeland. We can't take a chance that somebody else takes over Venezuela that doesn't have the good of the Venezuelan people in mind. We've had decades of that. We're not going to let that happen. We're there now, and what people don't understand, but they understand as I say this, we're there now, but we're going to stay until such time as the proper transition can take place. So we're going to stay until such time as we're going to run it, essentially, until such time as a proper transition can take place. As everyone knows, the oil business in Venezuela has been a bust, a total bust, for a long period of time. They were pumping almost nothing by comparison to what they could have been pumping and what could have taken place. We're going to have our very large United States oil companies, the biggest anywhere in the world, go in, spend billions of dollars, fix the badly broken infrastructure, the oil infrastructure, and start making money for the country. And we are ready to stage a second and much larger attack if we need to do so. So we were prepared to do a second wave if we needed to do so. We actually assumed that a second wave would be necessary, but now it's probably not. The first wave, if you'd like to call it that, the first attack was so successful, we probably don't have to do a second, but we're prepared to do a second wave, a much bigger wave, actually. This was pinpoint, but we have a much bigger wave that probably won't have to do. This partnership of Venezuela with the United States of America, a country that everybody wants to be involved with because of what we were able to do and accomplish, will make the people of Venezuela rich, independent, and safe. And it will also make the many, many people from Venezuela that are living in the United States extremely happy. They suffered. They suffered. So much was taken from them. They're not going to suffer anymore. The illegitimate dictator Maduro was the kingpin of a vast criminal network responsible for trafficking colossal amounts of deadly and illicit drugs into the United States. As alleged in the indictment, he personally oversaw the vicious cartel known as Cartel de las Soles, which flooded our nation with lethal poison responsible for the deaths of countless Americans, the many, many Americans, hundreds of thousands over the years of Americans died because of him. Maduro and his wife will soon face the full might of American justice and stand trial on American soil. Right now, they're on a ship. They'll be heading to, ultimately, New York. And then a decision will be made, I assume, between New York and Miami or Florida. But we have people where the overwhelming evidence of their crimes will be presented in a court of law. And I've seen it. I've seen what we have. It's both horrible and breathtaking that something like this could have been allowed to take place. For many years after his term as president of Venezuela expired, Maduro remained in power and waged a ceaseless campaign of violence, terror, and subversion against the United States of America, threatening not only our people, but the stability of the entire region. And you all saw it. In addition to trafficking gigantic amounts of illegal drugs that inflicted untold suffering and human destruction all over the country, all over, in particular, the United States, Maduro sent savage and murderous gangs, including the bloodthirsty prison gang Tren de Aragua, to terrorize American communities nationwide. And he did indeed. They were in Colorado. They took over apartment complexes. They cut the fingers off people if they call police. They were brutal, but they're not so brutal now. And I just have to congratulate our military, Pete, and everybody, and our National Guard, because the job that they've done, whether it's in Washington, D.C., where we have a totally safe city, where it was one of the most unsafe cities anywhere in the world, frankly, and now we have no crime in Washington, D.C. We haven't had a killing. We had the terrorist attack a few weeks ago. A little bit of a different kind of a threat. But we haven't had a killing in a long period of time, 6-7 months. We used to have two, on average, two a week in Washington, our capital. We don't have that anymore. The restaurants are opening. Everyone's happy. They're going, they're walking their daughters, they're walking their children, their wives, they walk to restaurants. Restaurants are opening all over Washington, D.C. So I want to thank the National Guard. I want to thank our military. And I want to thank law enforcement. It's been amazing. And they should do it with more cities. We're doing it, as you know, and we're doing it in Memphis, Tennessee right now, and crime is down. We just sort of started a few weeks ago, but crime is down now 77%. And the governor of Louisiana called, great person, and he wanted us to help him, as you know, in a certain very nice part of Louisiana. And we have done that. It's a rough, it was a rough section, and we have crime down. I understand it's down to almost nothing already after 2.5 weeks. New Orleans, it's down to almost nothing, and we've only been there for 2.5 weeks. Can't imagine why governors wouldn't want us to help. We also helped, as you know, in Chicago, and crime went down a little bit there. We did a very small help because we had no working ability with the governor. The governor was a disaster, and the mayor was a disaster. But it knocked down crime. But we're pulling out of there when they need us. We'll know. You'll know. You'll be writing about it. And likewise, Los Angeles, where we saved Los Angeles early on, where the head of the police department made a statement that if the federal government didn't come in, we would have lost Los Angeles. That's long after the fires. That's when they had the riots in Los Angeles. We did a great job. Got no credit for it whatsoever, but that's okay. It doesn't matter. We don't need the credit. But we'll be pulling out when they need us. They'll call, or we'll go back if we have to. We'll go back. But we did a great job in various cities. But the place that we're very proud of is Washington, D.C., because it's our nation's capital. We took it from being a crime-ridden mess to being one of the safest cities in the country. But the gangs that they sent raped, tortured, and murdered American women and children. They were in all of the cities I mentioned, Trinidad, Aragua. And they were sent by Maduro to terrorize our people, and now Maduro will never again be able to threaten an American citizen or anybody from Venezuela. There will no longer be threats. For years, I've highlighted the stories of those innocent Americans whose lives were so heartlessly robbed by this Venezuelan terrorist organization. Really one of the worst. One of the worst. They say the worst. Americans like 12-year-old Jocelyn Nungari from Houston. Beautiful Jocelyn Nungari. What happened to her? They, as you know, they kidnapped, assaulted, and murdered by Trinidad animals. They murdered Jocelyn. And left her dead under the bridge. There was a bridge that will never be the same to so many people after seeing what happened. As I've said many times, the Maduro regime emptied out their prisons, sent their worst and most violent monsters into the United States to steal American lives. And they came from mental institutions and insane asylums. They came from prisons and jails. The reason I say both, they sound similar. Actually, prisons, a little bit more hostile, a little bit tougher. A mental institution isn't as tough as an insane asylum, but we got them both. They sent from their mental institutions. They sent from their jails, prisons. They were drug dealers. They were drug kingpins. They sent everybody bad into the United States, but no longer. And we have now a border where nobody gets through. In addition, Venezuela unilaterally seized and stole American oil, American assets, and American platforms, costing us billions and billions of dollars. They did this a while ago, but we never had a president that did anything about it. They took all of our property. It was our property. We built it. And we never had a president that decided to do anything about it. Instead, they fought wars that were 10,000 miles away. We built Venezuela oil industry with American talent, drive, and skill, and the socialist regime stole it from us during those previous administrations, and they stole it through force. This constituted one of the largest thefts of American property in the history of our country. Considered the largest theft of property in the history of our country. Massive oil infrastructure was taken like we were babies, so we didn't do anything about it. I would have done something about it. America will never allow foreign powers to rob our people or drive us back into and out of our own hemisphere. That's what they did. Furthermore, under the now deposed dictator Maduro, Venezuela was increasingly hosting foreign adversaries in our region and acquiring menacing offensive weapons that could threaten U.S. interests and lives. And they used those weapons last night. They used those weapons last night, potentially in league with the cartels operating along our border. All of these actions were in gross violation of the core principles of American foreign policy, dating back more than two centuries, and not anymore. All the way back, it dated to the Monroe Doctrines. And the Monroe Doctrine is a big deal, but we've superseded it by a lot, by a real lot. They now call it the Donroe Document. I don't know. It's Monroe Doctrine. We sort of forgot about it. It was very important, but we forgot about it. We don't forget about it anymore. Under our new national security strategy, American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again. Won't happen. So just in concluding, for decades, other administrations have neglected or even contributed to these growing security threats in the Western Hemisphere. Under the Trump administration, we are reasserting American power in a very powerful way in our home region. And our home region is very different than it was just a short while ago. The future will be, and we did this in my first term. We had great dominance in my first term, and we have far greater dominance right now. Everyone's coming back to us. The future will be determined by the ability to protect commerce and territory and resources that are core to national security. These are core to our national security. Just like tariffs are, they've made our country rich. And they've made our national security strong, stronger than ever before. But these are the iron laws that have always determined global power. And we're going to keep it that way. We will secure our borders. We will stop the terrorists. We will crash the cartels. And we will defend our citizens against all threats, foreign and domestic. Other presidents may have lacked the courage or whatever to defend America. But I will never allow terrorists and criminals to operate with impunity against the United States. This extremely successful operation should serve as warning to anyone who would threaten American sovereignty or endanger American lives. Very importantly, the embargo on all Venezuelan oil remains in full effect. The American armada remains poised in position. And the United States retains all military options until United States demands have been fully met and fully satisfied. All political and military figures in Venezuela should understand what happened to Maduro can happen to them, and it will happen to them if they aren't just fair, even to their people. The dictator and terrorist, Maduro, is finally gone, and Venezuela people are free. Free again. It's been a long time for them, but they're free. America is a safer nation this morning. It's a prouder nation this morning because it didn't allow this horrible person, and this country that was doing very bad things to us, it didn't allow it to happen. And the Western Hemisphere is right now a much safer place to be. So I want to thank everybody for being here. I want to thank General Raisin Kane. He's a fantastic man. I've worked with a lot of generals. I worked with some I didn't like. I worked with some I didn't respect. I worked with some that just weren't good. But this guy is fantastic. I watched last night one of the most precise attacks on sovereignty. I mean, it was an attack for justice. And I'm very proud of him, and I'm very proud of our Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, who I'm going to ask to say a few words. Thank you very much.
This is live.